This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, the part of the program which we call The Big Picture. We're going to do something a little different today. When we first started doing this program together, it was back in 2001, shortly after what happened on 9/11. And so we have 18 years of an incredible experience here on the show. And we thought, since it's summertime and good for doing some reflection, it really helps in investment policy to look at how things have rolled over the last 18 years. Because sometimes, Jim, I think the markets have very, 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 very short memories, and they're all geared to the very next hill that they're rolling over, and they tend to forget all of the things that went before and the lessons that have been learned. So that's what we're going to do here today on the program, is do a review of the last 18 years and look at the roller coaster that it's been.
Yeah, it was really kind of incredible. And John, you know, maybe we ought to go back to when we first started this program. You and I started, I believe it was about a month or two right after the events of 9/11. And I was doing a local show, local daytime radio show at the time. And of course, we had put our website up, and I think it was 97 or 98, originally started as a newsletter. And one of the, I think it was in the year 2000, one of the local guys at the station, he said, "Have you ever thought of putting the show on the internet?" I said, "Well, how would I do that?" And he said, "Well, why don't I record it?" And he said, "I'll just load it up to your show." And so that was how the original Financial Sense internet program began in the year 2000. And then what happened is eventually I just got tired of doing daytime radio and left the radio station. So that sort of ended that program. And correct me, John, was it Don McElvaney's show? It was,
right, it was
a show you were doing engineering work, and they were interviewing me over my Perfect Storm series, I think, and that's how we met.
Yeah, Don McElvaney at the time, now he's retired. His son David has taken over their investment firm and their gold brokering firm, and we were producing Don's show, and you were a guest on that program. And then you needed someone to produce yours, and I get this phone call from somebody I don't know one day.
Yeah, I know, because I called Don up and I said, John, the engineer, how do I get in touch with that guy? And I think we did our first broadcast. It might have been the end of October or it might have been November, but it was right after the events of 9/11, which were so monumental. I mean, not since Pearl Harbor had the United States ever been attacked on its own soil. And it really took the country by surprise. But, you know, reflecting back over these 18 years, one of the reasons we're kind of doing this is this will be John and I's last program doing the show together. And we thought, why not look back at some of the events that we covered here on the program, the evolvement of the show over time, and then perhaps provide, since we've been both doing news, gosh, I've been doing radio since 87. And John, how long have you been in the news business?
Since 1965, 65, 66.
65. And right, you've been doing news. And so we thought we would provide some perspectives looking backwards. As I mentioned, we began this program with 9/11. But if you think of what happened right afterwards, we had the bursting of the tech bubble. The Fed took the Fed funds rate down to 1%, something they had never done before. Normally, when we got into recession, the Fed would take it down to 3%. Then in 2003, we had the Gulf War. 2005, we were seeing oil prices escalate. And I think, John, we went on summer recess in August of 2005. And I remember turning on the TV and seeing the events of Katrina and Rita. And we came back and I think we did a special program, of which we have done a number of times. And then you think about the real estate bubble, the Great Recession, and all the different programs that the Treasury and the Fed had to put together to turn the financial crisis around. I mean, we literally, folks, we had the commercial paper markets freeze up. The Fed had to backstop commercial paper, money market funds, companies. There was like $9 billion of backstopping. And the alphabet soup of programs in something, it's amazing to see but they went through this program of quantitative easing. John, had they announced something like quantitative easing when I first got in the business in the 1970s? My goodness, I hate to see how high interest rates would have gone. But even coming out of the Great Recession, we've seen an incredible decade. We saw quantitative easing. We saw interest rates get down to 0% on the Fed funds rate. And in 2016, we saw negative interest rates around the globe and the lowest interest rates we have seen in human recorded history. And not to mention the fact, leading up to the Great Recession, we began the decade with oil at $10 a barrel. And in the summer of 2008, it got to $150. And since then, we've had all kinds of events. We've had Arab Spring. And then we also had tech innovations. Just think of the things that you now have at your fingertips and how much the world has changed all around us. It began with 2007 with the introduction of the iPhone. Then we had the tablet. Then we had social media. Then we had Amazon, which is taking on brand and destroying brand loyalty. So we've seen an incredible period of time.
Yeah, and there are things that have come along that I don't think we would ever see. I never thought I would see the media that I've been in for over 50 years throw off all objectivity and begin taking sides in political contests, especially when we talk about, you know, what used to be what was on the op-ed page was opinion, what was reported as news, and they've quit all of that. And it's almost like a football game where the referees have decided they want to play in the game along with the players, you know. And I never quite thought I'd see that. They would always maintain some semblance of objectivity, but in many, many news outlets, that has been lost. Now, they may regain that, but for now, that's not the case.
You know, the other thing, too, coming out of this, and we saw this coming out of the bursting of the tech bubble. I mean, it's hard to believe that companies would go public in a single day. Their stock would double. And these were companies that didn't even have sales. You know, they were being valued on clicks. But coming out of that, we also had all of the accounting scandals that began with Enron, WorldCom. And I know, John, at least in our profession, you know, when we look at companies and we evaluate them, we look at earnings, but we don't pay as much attention to corporate earnings because what's the old joke with the accountant who's applying for a job is the financial chief and the boss asks him, what kind of numbers? And the accountant says, what do you want the numbers to be? And so today we do more of our analysis looking at free cash flow and the cash flow of the company because that's something you can't modify or change. You either have the cash or you don't have the cash in the bank. And so a lot of that changed in that period of time where people really began to question what was going on Wall Street, the accounting scandals, not only with WorldCom and Enron. It was hard to believe in 1999 that Enron was on the cover of Fortune magazine as one of the most admired companies in America, and the entire company was a fraud. And we saw it once again leading up to the financial crisis where you saw Wall Street began and the banking system began to securitize mortgages. Basically, that was the era of no-doc loans, liar loans, ninja loans, loans that were made to people that shouldn't have gotten a loan for a house. And they were repackaged in these securities. And really what was triple C, basically junk mortgages, were repackaged and given the label of triple A and sold to the public. And so it was a question not only of the news itself, accounting principles with accounting scandals, and also some of the entities that we rely on to give us evaluation. You know, you're going in the bond market and you're buying a bond for an investor. One of the things you're going to be looking at is what is the bond rating? Is it AAA rated? Because the financial rating kind of tells you the credit quality of the company. Well, a lot of those mortgages ended up being called into question. And that was something also that came out of that era.
You know, let's see if we can rewind the tape, so to speak, and go back to the beginning. I know back in the beginning of the 2000s, you had a very good series out there called The Perfect Financial Storm, in which you foresaw a lot of what happened, including the crash in 2007. Remember, we started talking about that in 2004 here on the program. But as a result of foreseeing a lot of the stuff, you were able to sidestep that for investors and for the people listening on the show.
You know, one of the things that really, I wrote The Perfect Financial Storm, I wrote a series called the Stock Market Series. And John, being raised on Graham and Dodd, Warren Buffett, value type investing, we were seeing things in the stock market that I'd never, ever seen in my career. You know, back then, Cisco had a valuation of $600 billion. Well, probably nothing compared to some of the companies that are going to be trillion-dollar companies here shortly. But we were looking at these companies, and I just couldn't make sense. And you probably remember the big scare. And if you've been around long enough, back in 1999, everybody was worried about Y2K when the clocks turned the clock January 1st, the year 2000, things wouldn't run because of computer glitches. I know our own firm, as a result of SEC requirements, I mean, we had to spend, I think it was close to $60,000 upgrading our computers, our software. So we were Y2K compliant. And I can remember in December where there was just a series of IPOs that were some of the silliest things that you would see. You were seeing things like, well, they got so many clicks or so many hits on their website. And I'm thinking to myself, they don't even have sales. How are we valuing these companies at $5, $10 billion? And I remember, you know, I think it was the second week in December, we completely got 100% out of the market. I mean, number one, it didn't make sense to me. Valuations didn't make sense. Number two, you know, I didn't know how real Y2K was. I mean, I can remember sailing in the bay New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1999, with the radio on in the boat, waiting to hear if the lights came on in Australia. I mean, companies were spending hundreds of millions of dollars to be Y2K compliant. But one of the things that came out of that is during that period of time, one of the fortunate things that we did is we saw our LEIs were telling us we were heading into a recession. So we figured the Fed would be shortly cutting interest rates. And it's hard to believe, you know, today, if I was to tell you this, nobody would believe it. But back then, we put 40% of our portfolio in foreign sovereign bonds. We went in mainly euro-denominated debt of Germany, France, Switzerland, Australia, and Canada. And that was just a place to hide because I was afraid to buy anything. Number one, I didn't know what was going to happen with Y2K. And number two, everything just looked so crazy from a valuation point of view. It just simply didn't make sense.
Maybe it's interesting to point out, too, that there was an article a year after Y2K, and what it said was the alarmists who had begun sounding the alarm in 1998, of which there were a few. They said up until 1998, nobody was thinking about this, the century rollover. And Dr. Ed Yardeni began holding, I think it was weekly or monthly conferences in which all the participants, of which we used to do this for a news purpose, would check and see what progress had been made. But the Wall Street Journal admitted a year after Y2K that if the alarmists had not jumped in there and began screaming and shouting, that we would have run out of time and there really would have been horrible disasters. So it was one of those things where some people were saying, nothing's going to happen. And other people were saying the world is going to end. In reality, it was in the middle. And it was the fact that we woke up soon enough to do something about it that disaster didn't get as bad as it could have.
You know, that's the one thing that bothers me today about so much of our infrastructure in this country. I don't care if it's the water system, the utilities, traffic lights, you know, the GPS in your car, your security system, and the show is stored in the cloud, is if something happened. I can remember, I think it was in early on in the decade, I think it was GTE, which eventually got taken over. One of their satellites went down. And so if you had your phone service with GTE, you couldn't use your phone. In fact, last summer, I did an interview with New York Times bestselling author on the book called The Mandibles. It's a book about the future. in the next decade. And there was a dark age period. It was a 2-year period where the infrastructure of the internet was taken out with a virus, or she didn't really go in. It was just taken down. It was called the dark ages, but it just goes to show you how technologically dependent we have become as a society. I mean, think of all the things that you do running your house, the GPS in your car, your phone, your business. Everything that we do today is on the net, and now it's migrating to the cloud. I mean, you've seen this change too in the stores. If you go into Costco, there used to be a big section on movies. That's now gone. Nobody's buying that. In fact, Best Buy just announced they're getting rid of CDs because nobody's doing that anymore. They're downstreaming it to your iPhone or your iPod, whatever you're using. So technological change came about in that same area. But the interesting thing is during that period of time, I read a book, I think it was 2001 it came out, and it was written by Jim Rogers. And Jim had gone around the world, I think for a 2-year period with his then girlfriend, now his wife, and wrote a book about commodities. And I latched onto that and looked at that. And I said, you know what? One area that makes a lot of sense is commodities. And I can attribute him and Barry Bannister is having a lot of influence on my thinking back then, because we began to move heavily into commodities. And as a result of emerging markets like China and India industrializing, and it was a good time period to be in commodities all the way up to roughly about 2011. And then it rolled over into a bear market. But it was interesting because we began that decade at oil prices got down to $10 a barrel in 1998. They were up to $35 a barrel in 2000. By 2008, in the summer of that year, they had gotten to $150 a barrel.
So we went from the froth of the tech bubble. It finally began to roll off in 1999. The markets, and I think at the time, Alan Greenspan was able to blame the roll off on what happened on 9/11. And really, it was blowing off before that. But then we got into the real crazies, and that were the unsecured loans, the subprime loans that were being made in the early 2000s, which of course completely unraveled in 2007. And there were very few voices out there. There were some, Brooks Lieborn and others, who were warning that things were radically not in touch with reality. And of course, the tragedy was many of these worthless instruments were being rated AAA, you know, as far as investment quality, which comes back to the old caveat emptor, let the buyer beware.
And, you know, it's interesting because not only did we see the accounting scandals that came out of the tech and bursting of the tech bubble, and here we were 5-6 years later dealing with basically the same thing with the way they were rating these mortgages. And we're seeing the same thing in some ways today. And we'll get to this later on as we bring you up to date to where we are now. And that is the current bubble, which is in passive index funds. And then also the concentration of risk, because one of the things that came out of the great financial crisis was Dodd-Frank. Everybody was afraid because the Fed was literally having to bail out everybody back then. And so the idea was, you know, we can't afford to have this again. We can't afford to bail out Wall Street. We can't afford to have big banks, big financial institutions. Well, guess what? Of all the investment banks, we're down to basically three big ones. And if you're talking about the banking system, five banks own over 93% of the derivatives, and three banks control almost 90% of the deposits in this country. So even though we were worried about financial concentration in the bigness that we had seen in these large institutions that ended up having to be bailed out by the Treasury in the Fed, we have actually have greater concentration today than when we were in 2007 and 2008. It's just absolutely fascinating to see how we go around in circles, and the very things you think you've solved, the problems you thought have gone away, they're still there underneath the surface. And in many cases, as we'll point out, they've actually gotten bigger.
Okay, after we have an event like 2007, same as what happened during the Great Depression, the politicians always want to run in and say, oh my, how could this possibly have happened? When you and I both know that a lot of them saw it coming anyway. And then they start proposing regulation and resolution and law, which is supposed to, quote, prevent that from happening again, end quote. And then we began to see Dodd-Frank and what happened to banking institutions.
You know, they actually got bigger. I mean, when Bear Stearns went under, the Fed engineered a bailout with J.P. Morgan, and there were several others. And it always puzzled me why they let Lehman go under, because that led to a domino effect that just rippled through the system. Merrill Lynch went under. AG went under. Biggest, largest insurance company, a $1 trillion company, went under. And it just floored me the way they did that. So they put together these regulations that restrict banks and their trading. And one of the things that, if you've listened to this program, one of my next crisis points that we're going to be talking about in our fall upcoming seminar, which we're calling again the perfect storm, is what is happening to liquidity. Bank inventories used to be $300 billion. They're down to what, about $30 billion? So liquidity is drying up in the financial markets. And this applies also to sovereign debt as well as corporate debt. A lot of the debt that you see in a lot of the bond funds, whether they're ETFs or they're a mutual fund, quite honestly, those bonds could not be liquidated in 7 days. And if you have a mutual fund, you're supposed to get your money, what is it, in 3 days, 4 days, or whatever it is. There's simply no way. In fact, they had a classification internally with the SEC for bonds that cannot be liquidated within a 7 day period of time. So a lot of these regulations, John, actually have driven liquidity and made it worse. And also it impeded the credit mechanism, because a lot of the recovery process that we saw coming out of the recession is banks were reluctant to lend. And it's only been probably, I would say, in the last couple of years that we've seen credit flows begin to merge. We're seeing that on the consumer front. We're also seeing it in commercial industrial loans now. We saw it in mortgages, although mortgage financing in housing seems to be taking a hit. I think that's probably a combination of rising prices, low inventory stock, and rising interest rates. And the fourth factor was the change in the tax laws that removed a good majority of the deductibility of property taxes, limited mortgage expense. And so consequently, sometimes they pass legislation, and I don't think they think it all the way through in terms of the consequences of their actions.
Now what we need to do, Jim, is make the transition from what we would call the recovery years after the crash. Many people sat huddled on the sideline, to what became the fascinating years because of all the things that began to happen.
You know, that's the interesting thing that came out of this. And by the way, for those of you that are fully invested in index funds and think you can't lose money, I just want to give you an example. If you were in an index fund in January of 2000, and you were in a, let's say you had your money in a 401k, it was all in S&P. In the next 2 years, you lost 50% of your value. The S&P in the next 5 years would peak in September of 2007, and then you would lose 58% of your money in the next couple of years. So it wasn't until April of 2013 that the S&P finally, for the first time, exceeded the highs that were reached in March of 2000. So for 13 years, your money went nowhere. And one of the other things that made this recovery probably more unusual, John, is at least in my lifetime, I never thought I'd see the day where you would see not only 0% interest rates, but a third of all sovereign bonds in the world in the summer of 2016 had a negative interest rate, meaning that you paid the government interest to loan them money. And that is something we have never seen in my entire career. And of course, that had a major, major impact on a lot of individuals in terms of their retirement, delaying it, and the type of retirement lifestyle. And that was basically out of low interest rates and those low returns, that sort of gave birth to the program that we have on the air on Mondays and Tuesdays, lifetime income for many boomers, 10,000 of you each day heading into retirement. Finding a dependable source of income has become paramount to any plan that you're doing in considering your retirement. That was something that was also unusual.
You know, one of the things that does stand out is that people recognize that mortgage and individual debt contributed to the crisis that triggered it. And a lot of people are under the impression now that we've tamed that, that the debt's paid down. But as you and many of your guests have pointed out, the amount of global debt is bigger than ever.
Oh, it's massive. And that was something that Robin Griffith made a reference to in the first hour. And he said in the next decade, he said, on the positive side, returns will revert to the median and they'll be lower than they traditionally are. That's the best case. And it's not just Robin Griffith, Jeremy Grantham, and several well-respected people have made that reference that that's what's coming. And then on the other side, Robin Griffith, as he mentioned in the first hour, he said the worst case scenario is the mother of all bear markets. I mean, it's no secret, you know, debt doubled under Bush, debt doubled under Obama. And, you know, who knows how many terms Trump will assume. I don't think it will double. I mean, under Trump, because in 8 years, that means the debt would have to go from 20 trillion to 40 trillion. John, there's no way that we could handle $40 trillion of debt. That would consume almost 60-70% of the government's budget, not to mention entitlement. There would be a debt jubilee or something. But sooner or later, all of that debt's going to catch up. What looks good right now, and I think this is what you're making reference to, is you'll often hear commentators make reference, well, you know, debt to equity ratios look good. So let's assume, for example, let me just give you a margin example. Let's assume you have a $100,000 stock portfolio, but you have $50,000 of margin debt. Everything looks good because your stock portfolio is worth $100,000. What happens when the stock portfolio falls from $100,000 down to $70,000 and you have $50,000 of margin debt? All of a sudden, the debt to equity ratio doesn't look as good. And that's some of the issues that we're dealing now. And that's one of the reasons we like individual bonds, is because we can control the risk that we take, especially if we're looking at sovereigns or corporates, because you have no idea how liquid and how low the quality. The vast majority of bonds that are being issued in the corporate sphere right now are basically triple B. In other words, they're one notch above junk bond status. Double B, you revert to junk bond status. A lot of the bonds are in triple B, and it wouldn't take much of a pullback in the economy or a recession to turn those triple Bs into double B and junk bond, or even worse.
Now, the roller coaster ride of oil, because if you remember originally, for a long time, we were very, very concerned that by the middle of this decade, we'd be in a severe peak oil crisis. And all things being equal, we would have been. You saw prices going up and up, etc. And then all of a sudden, the shale production came online and the prices just went down to below $30 a barrel, which astonished everyone. Now they're headed upwards again. And I'm not sure people are aware of where this is heading. And it's actually working in tandem with the Federal Reserve's interest rates to slow things down.
And that's about the only thing they can do. People do not realize how tight the oil markets are right now. Inventories are dropping. There has been a severe cutback, and the IEA keeps warning, both at the sovereign level and at the international oil company level, the amount of investment that has been cut back in the oil industry. And it's happening on Wall Street. If you look at the oil stocks that are doing well with this rise in oil, it's not the big oil companies that are investing, you know, companies like Exxon that are going to invest $50 billion in oil plays here in the U.S. It's the companies that are buying back their stock, increasing their dividends, and basically not making investments. And sooner or later, that's going to catch up. Oil, assuming next year, you know, we're looking at a recession probably towards the end of 2019, maybe 2020, depends on how fast the Fed raises interest rates. because the bulk of the stimulus, here's, if there's any good news over the next 12 months, there's about $500 billion of fiscal stimulus that's going to hit the U.S. economy. And that was one of the references Robin Griffith was making in hour one, is only the strong survive. And the best place to be right now is in the U.S. But, you know, if you take a look at the oil, it's getting tight, John. A lot of investment, whether it's deep offshore or major new projects, they're just, a lot of these companies from Exxon all the way down are not making those investments. In a lot of the places where there is oil, it's difficult to get to, like deep water, Brazil, and places in the world where political uncertainty, whether it's Nigeria, whether it's Libya, whether it's the Middle East, and even in the South China Seas, a lot of companies have taken a lot of risk. I mean, take a look at what happened to a lot of companies that invested billions and billions of dollars in Venezuela. It's one of the reasons that Venezuela's oil production has gone down is ConocoPhillips won a court case, and they've been seizing Venezuelan tankers and assets to get paid back. So a lot of the places you want to go for oil today is not very safe, or it's going to be costly to get to. So this oil situation can get a lot tighter. But the only thing, there's a couple sayings in the oil industry. The cure for low prices is low prices, because at low prices, people stop drilling, they stop producing. And the cure for high prices is high prices. As prices head higher, people consume less, and eventually it costs more, people drive less, you get surcharges added on to travel, whether you're truckers delivering merchandise to stores, or you're getting on an airplane taking a trip. And so I think prices are heading higher. I still hold to that belief, and I think you're going to see that.
Now it's time to talk about the new bubble, especially when we look at passive index funds and their contribution to extreme valuations. The financial concentration of wealth, you know, this oftentimes is a political thing, but in reality, the financial concentration of wealth in just a few hands is becoming incredible. And then the risk of liquidity as well. These are the new emerging trends.
Yeah. And this was something that we're putting together for our upcoming seminar this fall in October. And we're once again calling it the perfect storm, because we see these events converging and coming together. Number one, and who knows if what we saw this Friday with the pullback in technology stocks, even though we got a great print on GDP, but it was something that I really began looking at last year. It was amazing when I took a look at some of these companies, and it's gotten actually worse since last year. And that's whether you're looking at Amazon, Netflix, the valuations of these companies are so astronomical. I remember during the tech bubble when the price of Cisco got to be a market valuation of close to $600 billion. Now you're looking at the race between Apple and Amazon to become, and maybe closely behind Alphabet, to become the first $1 trillion companies in history. And the reason that that's taken place is the majority of the money that's going into the market today, whether it's going into bond funds or it's going into stock funds, it's going into index funds. And an index fund is a passive investment. They make no analysis on the companies. If a company is in the index, whatever weighting it carries in the index, that's what the fund manager buys. And because these indexes are what we call market cap weighting, meaning the larger the valuation of the company, the greater the weight it carries in the index. And so the more of that company has to be bought. I think, you know, almost $10 out of every $100 that goes into an index fund goes in just three or four companies. That's it. And so that's what keeps driving these valuations. And something that I brought up with many of the technicians and experts we've had here on the program is, what happens if Amazon gets to be an $1,800 or $2,000 company? Who in the heck buys it? Which leads to the second theme that we've been developing here, and that is financial concentration. You've got three major fund groups that control 88% of the index fund. So imagine three guys in a room, and they all come to the conclusion we need to get out of the market, or their clients are bailing out of them. Who in the heck are they going to sell to? if the three of you own the market, folks, you are the market. And that is something that I don't think we've ever really explored the ramifications. And I'm sure in the next downturn, there will be all kinds of committee hearings and talk about that. Even the founder of Vanguard, Vogel, recently said, what's going on in the index area is just absolutely crazy. And it's just like last week, Craig Johnson made a point of there are actually more ETFs today than there are stocks. And it's the other thing that's happened. Almost a third of the stocks have disappeared. They've either been bought out, taken over, merged with another company. Is one of the things that we've seen since going on in 2010. The biggest driver of the stock market hasn't been the individual investor or institutions. It's been mainly companies buying back their own stock to the tune of almost $500 billion a year. So you have financial concentration. You have it in just two investment banks, maybe possibly three on Wall Street. You have it with four banks when it comes to deposits, five banks when it comes to derivatives. And when it comes to mutual funds, you're talking about five mutual fund families that control the bulk of financial assets. So you have seen this huge concentration that has come out of the Great Recession, where this was the subject of so much debate, that how did we ever allow these large companies to get so levered up that the government and the Fed had to come in with literally trillions of dollars to bail out these companies? Well, I hate to tell you, those companies and the industry itself is more concentrated today than it has ever been in the history of the world.
And you have to realize the implications of this, because it does relate to the whole idea of liquidity, because if three gentlemen in a room control, what, you know, say 88% of the market, then to whom are they going to sell if things are going down?
And that is one of the things that, there was a law that came in. I'm trying to think what year it came in. And that is mutual funds can break the buck, meaning that, you know, if you have your money in a money market fund, you better make sure it's in treasuries, because in the next downturn, if a mutual fund has to break the buck, in other words, if you want to take your money out, you may not get a buck. You may get 96 cents. You may get 94 cents. And that's because, as anything else in the world, when you go to shop for income, well, guess what? You're shopping on the basis of yield. That's how bond funds are sold. That's how money market funds are sold. Well, if you're looking and shopping for a money market fund and you're basing it on how much yield that fund gives, you better ask yourself, what are they investing in that they're offering a yield that is so much higher than everybody else? It may be because they are taking higher risk with credit quality and liquidity in terms of the actual bonds that they own. And part of this also, John, was created by regulations that basically took the banks out of being an intermediary when it came to providing liquidity in the markets. And that is a very, very dangerous aspect that has not been tested. Once again, financial concentration, indexing, and liquidity have not been stress test. We have no idea what this will be like. And a good example was what we saw with some of these short volatility funds that we saw at the end of January, beginning of February. Within 5 or 6 short days, the market was down 12%. And those volatility funds lost 90%. They were basically wiped out. It's one of the things that we have been thinking about in planning, at least for what we're doing for our clients, and thinking this through, because quite honestly, I don't want to be reassured by James Powell that tells me, you know, I don't need to worry about the dollar, don't need to be worrying about the markets. In fact, Ben Bernanke recently said, you know, things are looking pretty good, not worried about anything. Remember, that's the same Ben in 2007 that says, what, me worry about real estate? Real estate has always been a great investment. Well, right before the peak. So, you know, I don't want to rely on some politician or some Fed chairman or Fed governor and tell me, hey, there's nothing to worry about, we got your back. Well, you saw what happened during the financial crisis. It took extraordinary measures to turn the markets around, and it didn't happen overnight.
Well, here we are looking back over 18 years. And if you had to do some perspectives of things that you've learned, maybe about how the news is covered, both financial and political, lessons that we should carry forward into the future? What would they be?
You know, the one thing is you can't take things at face value anymore. You know, this really went out in the bursting of the tech bubble when we had all those accounting scandals with Enron. You really question earnings. In fact, I mean, we look at earnings, but that's not the main measure of which we evaluate companies. We look at their balance sheet for debt and we look at free cash flow. The other thing, John, is the amazing thing that we have seen with technology. If you look at, for example, Warren Buffett, he made a lot of his money in newspapers, in media, investing in the major networks like ABC, it was Capital Cities at the time, and the Washington Post. These were near monopolies. I mean, you know, Buffett often talked about, you know, if you're the local newspaper in the town, I can remember when I got in the business and I was running ads in the local paper for seminars, I had to pay the going price because it was the only paper in town and that's what you paid for. Take a look at what happened to the Washington Post. What's happening to the New York Times? I mean, they are mere shadows of their former self. Jeff Bezos, I think he paid $250 million. He bought the Washington Post personally. At one time, I know the Washington Post had a valuation of $10 billion. Take a look at what the smartphone is doing in terms of the way you shop, the way you communicate. Think of what Google and Facebook have disrupted in the advertising world. Think of what Amazon has done to name brand images. I mean, all of the branded companies that used to have monopolies on their brand, they're struggling now with margins. They're lowering their prices. One of the examples I can give you is Procter & Gamble, which owns Gillette. I can remember going to Costco to buy my razor blades and you would get a pack of 16. It was the best place to get your razor blades. And then you got a pack of only 14. Then you only got a pack of 12. Well, now it's a pack of 16 and the price is less because of competition and the branding power just doesn't carry the weight it does. So we're always going to have technology and it's going to be changing. Every market will always end in the same way. It will end with things becoming overvalued, an asset class. You know, it was technology in the late 90s. It was real estate in the early decade. And right now it's indexing funds and technology once again. So those things will always remain the same. And that's why I think having a knowledge of macroeconomics, because what happens in the world today is closely integrated. If we do something, and this is the thing that really kind of bothers me about the Fed, because as it continues to raise interest rates, it's creating disparities between our interest rates here and the rates around the globe, where in Europe, they're still negative and much lower and next to nothing in Japan, that a lot of debt that was taken on from the financial crisis was dollar-denominated debt in emerging markets. And that is a problem, and that's where we think the epicenter of the crisis is going to emerge from, there and in Europe. And John, you know, even though we're changing, even though technology is different, the things of value, the things of business cycle, much of that hasn't changed at all and is still the same. I'm always wary I keep hearing somebody say, this time it's different.
A lot of things in the media, I mean, the media have changed radically, largely a broadcast, but print as well. And I was thinking the same thing you were when I was in Colorado last week, looking at the Denver Post. It used to be a really hefty newspaper. Of course, the Rocky Mountain News, its competitor, had been bought out by the Post, and now it's a relatively small one. But the perspective of the Post is still lopsided, and they can't seem to figure that out. You know, the people who cover the stories, that they need more diversity inside of their staffs. So that's been the first one thing. The second thing that has been really good on these changes has been that we have a vibrant, independent media now, thanks to the technology on the internet. We can do podcasts. You can do actual radio broadcasts from virtually anywhere now. We can post stories. And there are a lot of credible sites out there that are letting you know what's happening without having to go to what were the traditional media. So it's like at one time, the media were the watchers at the gate, so to speak. But now the watchers have watchers, and we're almost getting watchers upon watchers. And it can get a little confusing because you have to figure out how to determine what is fake news and what is real news. And let's face it, the whole nature of politics alone is deception, because it's a warfare. And deception, as Sun Tzu said, is warfare. And so it's a lot of verbal sparring, things that cover up other things, semantics used to hide things. And if you're truth-oriented, which I try to be, you have to dig down through this. And so if you don't have time to do that as a listener, you need to find those sources which are really good and which told you the truth in the past and accurately predicted where we were headed, and then trust them for the future. You know, but it's always caveat emptor. I think that's the one big change that I've seen in these last 20 years.
Yeah. And for me, it's almost like some of the information I have boiled down a lot of my information. Mainly we get private research, which I place a lot more reliability in terms of the information, because research houses are only as good as their research. If they give you lousy information, you don't continue subscribing to their research. We internally rely on doing our own research and information that we get from several respected research firms. And we spend a lot of money in that area because, you know, if you just read the papers each day, and I'm talking about even institutions like the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, I can't tell you the number of times I've seen stories retracted, and you just can't take information on the surface to be what it is. Like I said, I'd learned in the last decade very, very early. In fact, I hired an accounting professor back in 1997 because we were looking at companies, and then all of a sudden, and this was before some of these scandals came out, but it just, accounting became more complex, especially with the use of derivatives and which ways you can manipulate earnings. And so I hired an accounting professor from San Diego State to come teach a special course of forensic accounting, because you almost had to be like a detective and look through the financial statements to really dig in and find out what the real story was behind companies. Because let's face it, you know, companies want to put out their best face. They want their earnings to beat earnings. And, you know, you read an annual report, it's got glossy covered pictures and everything looks rosy. I find it very helpful, you know, when I read a 10-K statement, to read what management said. And if I see a bunch of excuses, or they gloss over about something they said last year they were going to initiate and didn't accomplish, that's usually, so I spend a lot more time looking at the qualitative aspects of a company today than just the financial numbers themselves. And so it has become a complex world that we live in. I mean, we have a plethora of sources of information just in the internet. I mean, think about anything you're doing research on. And this is the one great thing about where we are today. Just go to Google and just type it in, and you have a wealth of information in terms of research at your fingertips, which is one of the reasons why I believe we're seeing technological innovation march at such a quickening pace. And one of the problems is it's moving at such a quickening pace that our regulators and even our politicians can't keep pace with it. And it's truly a fascinating time to be living in as we are today. Well, John, reflecting after 18 years, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to be co-hosting this show with you. And I just want to say, I wish you, your family, and everybody at the Leffler household all the best in the future. And may you have a pleasant tomorrow.
No, I do appreciate that. And we're going to be involved in some other projects that I want to be involved in. They can always find us at my, I do a weekly radio show, which I've been doing for almost 30 years, on economics, politics, and religion and the interactions of the three. And that's at steelonsteel.com, steelonsteel.com. And that's always available there. But we're hoping to do some things in the area of how to spot fake news, come up with a YouTube channel called The Dialectical Dojo, teaching people how to do mental martial arts when they're seeing information flow at them. How do you determine what is and isn't fake news, based on my 50 years or so of doing news work in the industry, news and news talk radio. So we're looking forward to it. It's definitely not retirement in the traditional sense. I think for those of us who have been in radio this long, as my my wife will occasionally said, she said, well, you'll stop doing radio when they pull the mic from your cold, dead hands. You know,
so, you know, I started in news probably a little bit later than you. I started in 87. Then I did television for 2 years between 90 and 91. But I've become a news junkie. You know, when I'm on my phone, I'm always looking. I have a couple websites I go to looking for breaking news and story. I don't know what it is about being in the news. You become addicted to it. It's almost like a drug in a way.
It does. My producer has the same problem. You know, even on holidays, we'll call up. Did you see this? We got to roll this out and do other stuff, you know? And you have to literally turn the thing off. I put on audiobooks and listen to that instead, and then try to resist the urge to, when you get bored, grab the iPad and flip it up and see what's going on out there. So yeah, you're right. The whole concept of media, doing radio, television, it's an addiction and it never seems to go away.
Yeah, that was the thing that really surprised me when I did television news. You know, you'd get off the set. I used to come on the air at 10:45 at night, and, you know, I'd leave Friday and I was looking forward to the weekend. But in the news business, if something breaks, something happens on a Saturday or Sunday, John, they expect you in the studio. I mean, it was just like, I forget what it was. It was during the crisis with Boris Yeltsin. There was a so-called coup, and it happened on the weekend or something. And I can remember them calling me, asking me to come in. And I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to say? The financial markets are closed. I have no idea what they're going to open up on Monday. But they still wanted me in the studio because you had to come up and cover it and say something. And that's just part of being in the news business. Well, John, all the best, and I look forward to your new endeavor.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate it. And, well, we'll see where it goes with your show in the future, too. So, like I said, it's an addiction.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
God bless.
You know, once again, I would just like to thank John Loeffler and his team for 18 years of being part of the program. Some incredible, interesting years covering the news, not to mention the fact a lot of times there was a standing joke. Every time we'd take August recess off, something bad would happen. Katrina, Rita, terrorist attacks, earthquakes, or something like that. But once again, I do want to extend a special thanks to John and his team for making Financial Sense. And, you know, it's kind of interesting reflecting back over those 18 years. There have been a lot of variations and reiterations of the show. At one time, it was hard to believe the show was 5 hours long. And based on listener input, it was one of the reasons why there's basically six programs a week. There is the weekend show, which you're listening to now. On Monday and Tuesday, there's Lifetime Income, which really was input from listeners, as we covered many times on the weekend programs, financial topics of a financial planning nature, whether it was a complex tax bill or something like that. That later evolved into Lifetime Income, which we have on Monday. And then we had input from listeners on covering issues of health. That has evolved. I'm really excited. I've got a three-part series I'm going to have on devices that could actually save your life. We're starting that. Next Tuesday is the first of a three-part series. And then, of course, we eventually had FS Insider. Those are in-depth interviews over a three-day period. And we are going to be making some new improvements and changes in the program going forward based on a lot of feedback that we've gotten from a lot of you. So Financial Sense will continue, but maybe it may be a little different than it's been in the past.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.